Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. This show is brought to you by ChrisCresser.com, and I'm your host, Steve Wright from SCDLifestyle.com. With me is integrative medical practitioner and healthy skeptic Chris Cresser. Chris, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing very well as well.
Good. So we have a Q&A episode today. I'm not going to talk about any studies to begin with. We're just going to dive right into questions. But before I do that, I'm very happy to announce that just this morning I finished the last sentence of the rough draft of my book, which feels really good.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you end with a period or an exclamation point?
It was a period, Steve.
Oh, okay.
This is just the rough draft. There's another, you know, there's a whole round of edits, but we've already actually started some of the edits. I think it will go pretty fast, so I'm pretty excited. It's been a lot of fun writing the book, but it's also, of course, been a lot of work, so I'm glad to be, coming to the end of that chapter, so to speak.
Yeah, so this is June when we're recording this, and you started the manuscript back in, November?
Yeah, I guess November or December. But I didn't really start writing in earnest until probably March or April. So it was a pretty fast turnaround.
Cool. Well, congratulations. Good luck on the next part.
Thank you.
So before we get going into Q&A, what did you have for breakfast?
Let's see. What did I have? Okay, so we had these lamb merguez sausages, which were really good. And we made some potato hash browns, which we just peeled russet potato, grated it on a box grater, and then cooked it in some bacon grease. And we have one of these, it's like a grill. Not a grill, what do you call these things, Steve? You know, they're for making pancakes.
Griddle?
A griddle, that's right.
See, very close to a grill.
All my brain power has just been dumped into the book. So it's electric. You put it on the counter and plug it in, and it has a little temperature gauge, and we use that to make hash browns. Not a lot of pancakes happening around here these days, but it's really good for hash browns. And then I made some steamed broccolini that we got from the farmer's market, and with a little bit of olive oil and salt, just pretty simple. And then some sea kraut, so like a sauerkraut with cabbage and some sea vegetables.
Sounds pretty delish.
It was good.
Cool. Before we roll into the Q&A, let me tell everyone about Beyond Paleo. So if you're new to this podcast, or if you're new to the paleo diet, maybe you haven't been to ChrisCresser.com yet. If so, you need to go over there right now. And when you get over there, you're going to see this big red box. And what Chris has done is he put together a free 13-part email series called Beyond Paleo. Now, this series is all of Chris's best tips and tricks and ideas surrounding how to burn fat, boost energy, and prevent and reverse disease without drugs. So when you see that big red box, go ahead and put your name and email in that box, and Chris will send over the first email very soon.
All right. So I do want to talk just for a moment or two about my private practice situation before we jump into the questions. As many know, my private practice has been closed to new patients for a little over a year, I think. I don't remember the exact date. I only see patients 2 days a week, so I can have time to continue to do research and develop new treatment protocols and speak publicly and write the blog and do the radio show and develop new educational products and write a book and do all the other things that I do that make me who I am and, inform my work. And the downside of that is that I can't see as many new patients as I would otherwise like to. And then the way I work with patients is pretty intensive. I start with a really detailed case review process that where I spend time reviewing their case even before we meet. And so it's very time consuming for me to see new patients as much as I enjoy doing it. So the long and the short of it is I can only see, when I am taking new patients, about 4 to 6 new patients a week. And so I reopened on Monday on a waitlist basis. We had finally made it through the previous waitlist that we had, and within a couple hours of sending the email, there were over 200 people on the waitlist, and by the end of the week, there were 600. So we had to close the waitlist down and figure out what to do about this situation, because it's really it's difficult, because I want to make myself available and help as many people as possible, and the blog, all the articles on the blog and the radio show and the digital programs and everything out that I do for free, I know I get great feedback from people, and I know a lot of folks have been helped by that. But of course there are people who, even though they've read everything that I've written and listened to all the podcasts and, you know, have done a lot of the digital programs, are still experiencing problems and need additional help. And it can be really frustrating when you feel like you're doing everything you can and you're still not getting the results that you want. And unfortunately, there just aren't that many practitioners out there yet, that approach things in this way, you know, that we talk about on the blog and the podcast. And, you know, there certainly aren't enough to meet the demand. There's a really huge demand. A lot of people are really dissatisfied with the kind of care they get in the conventional model, and even the kind of care they get from some alternative practitioners. So in a perfect world, I'd be able to see every single patient that wanted to see me, but in the real world, that's simply not going to be possible, unfortunately. And I think it's likely to only get worse when the book comes out. So this all happened pretty fast, and I'm doing the best that I can to figure out an equitable solution. In the long term, I'm going to create, you know, my plan is to create a clinician training program to train others in my approach. And then that, of course, can evolve into a referral network where I can refer patients to people that have gone through the program or other like-minded practitioners that, you know, I feel confident in referring patients to. I want to create some more advanced level patient trainings, like a health mastery program, for example, that just takes people through maybe a 6-month course with all of my best thoughts and tips on nutrition and lifestyle and supplements, with a little more detail and support and handholding than is available, you know, just by reading a book or following my blog. And then I want to create modules for particular health conditions like hypothyroidism and weight loss and autoimmune disease and skin disorders and things like that. I'm going to be talking about all this stuff in my book, but because of length concerns, I was only able to really do about 7 to 10 pages for each condition, which obviously isn't enough to do them full justice. I mean, it's going to be a great help for people especially people who haven't seen all this stuff in one place. But what I'm talking about here are much more in-depth modules on those conditions, kind of similar to the high cholesterol action plan, a healthy baby code. So that's the good news. The bad news is all of that stuff will take time to develop. And, you know, between continuing my private practice and seeing the patients that I have and writing the book and doing everything else, it could be a few years before all that stuff's available. So in the meantime, we decided to do a lottery system to generate a random sequence of numbers, and then use that to determine what the order of the wait list will be. And I really thought a lot about this. I talked to friends and I talked to colleagues. I turned it around over and over in my head a lot, and there were a lot of different ideas proposed. And in the end, the lottery seemed like the best solution. It's certainly not perfect. It's all based on chance, and it means that some people who really need to see me might, you know, end up being very low on the wait list, and perhaps other people whose need isn't as great might be higher on the wait list. But there's really no way, I think, no easy way to qualify that or determine that without just going over the top in terms of staffing and resource needs. So I hope everyone understands, and I'm really sorry, you know, especially if you end up getting a low number on the list. I wish there was more that I could do about this, but this, I think this is the best it can be for right now. And the, you know, down the line, if we train some more practitioners and get some more programs out there, I hope that we can meet your needs that way.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that you put a lot of thought into this, Chris. And, you know, I think that it's a good and bad problem to have, but I'm glad that you took the time to explain it to people, because I think, you know, just hearing the deliberation and how it happened, I think will help people really understand it when, you know, words can only say so much. We can't really get the full emotion of the gravity of not only health, but how much you can do in a day.
Yeah, and I just want to say, I mean, I've been on the other side. You know, I think a lot of people know my story. I was chronically and seriously ill for many, many years. And I know what it's like to be in that place. I know what it's like to feel the desperation of having tried everything and not getting well, and to feel the hope of finding a practitioner that you think might be able to help, and then not being able to see that person for any number of reasons. That happened to me on numerous occasions as I was navigating my own health journey. And I just want to say that in each case, for me, although those experiences were disappointing, in the end, I did find, you know, my own path and the way that worked for me. And I'm confident that even though it may not seem that way right now, and if someone's not able to see me, that there are a lot of skilled practitioners out there, and they're, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. So I just encourage you to keep trying, keep looking, keep your mind and your ears open, and hopefully the right solution will present itself.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I got to keep that state of abundance that, you know, I've had the similar experiences as well, for a number of reasons, and just keep that thought of abundance even when, you know, all your health problems are stacking up against you, that as long as you keep fighting, you're going to keep gaining ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, acceptance and also perseverance at the same time. It's that kind of walking the razor's edge. So we got some good questions. Let's get to it.
All right. So first question comes from Nina. Dear Chris, I've heard some of your podcasts on managing hypothyroid Hashimoto's, and I have a question about balancing goitrogens in the diet with iodine and selenium. I can't find this address anywhere online, just blanket admonitions to avoid iodine or avoid goitrogens. So could you give me some more nuanced information? That would be great. Thanks, Nina.
So the connection between goiter and goitrogenic foods has been known for about 80 years. Back in 1929, researchers produced a goiter in animals, in rabbits, by feeding them cabbage. And goiter, which is a swelling of the thyroid gland, is most frequently caused by either iodine deficiency or exposure to chemicals or drugs that somehow block or the uptake of iodine or interfere with its utilization. Now, there are some foods that have been shown to be goitrogenic when they're eaten in excess, or if they're eaten even in moderation, but background intakes of iodine are low. And this is what the questioner is referring to with goitrogenic foods. And we have talked a little bit about this before. These include cassava, which is also manioc or yuca, soy products, millet, sweet potatoes, cruciferous vegetables like cabbage, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, bok choy, kale, and collard greens. Now, there's a little bit of a nuance to the whole goitrogenic story. So at relatively low concentrations, they decrease the uptake of iodine in the thyroid gland from other foods that we eat. So for example, if you're eating, you know, goitrogens and you're also eating some seaweeds and other foods that contain iodine, you'll still get iodine from those foods, but you'll get a little less than you would if you were eating no goitrogens at all. But that's not a problem if you're eating a substantial, you know, an adequate amount of iodine-rich food like seaweeds and sea vegetables, for example. Or if you're supplementing with iodine, you know, at maybe 800 micrograms or more per day, if you're getting that amount of iodine in your diet, relative, you know, a moderate intake of the foods that I just listed is not likely to interfere with iodine. Well, it will interfere, but it won't interfere enough to prevent you from getting the iodine that you need. But at high concentrations, goitrogens actually interfere with the incorporation of iodine into thyroid hormone itself. And this means that even if there's enough iodine in the diet or through supplements going into the gland, it can't be properly utilized, and therefore no amount of supplemental iodine or you know high amounts of iodine-containing foods like seaweed would be able to overcome a really high intake of goitrogenic foods. And it's another thing to be aware of is it's commonly believed that cooking or fermenting reduces the goitrogenic effect, but again, it's a little more nuanced when you look at it, look at the details. Fermenting cabbage in the sauerkraut actually increases the goitrogens that it contains, but it reduces the amount of nitriles, which is another type of chemical that's present in some foods like cabbage that has a toxic effect on the thyroid. In fact, it's even a more harmful effect than goitrogens. And nitriles, unlike goitrogens, the effects of nitriles can't be offset by iodine intake or iodine supplementation. So with fermentation, you do have an increase in goitrogens, but you have the nitriles, which are even more harmful and not offset by iodine, are cut in half. So we might say that the net effect of the fermentation of cabbage and you know probably other goitrogenic foods is either neutral or even positive because of the reduction of nitriles. Most forms of cooking do reduce goitrogens, but they don't eliminate them entirely, and it depends on the cooking method. So, for example, steaming cruciferous veggies until they're fully cooked reduces goitrogens by about 35%. Boiling vegetables for 30 minutes, although I don't know when you would do that except if you were making soup because they're going to turn to mush, that destroys 90% of the goitrogens if the water is discarded. So you would drain the water. Of course, you would boil yuca, and it's very important to boil yuca for 30 minutes before you have it actually, which is again also cassava and manioc, because it has it's goitrogenic, and it also has some other potentially toxic chemicals. It's also worth pointing out that cooking greatly reduces the formation of nitriles in most cases, which we just talked about as being even potentially more harmful than goitrogen. So to put all this together in kind of practical terms, I think even if you have a thyroid condition, if you have sauerkraut as a condiment, like one or two tablespoons with meals, and maybe 3 to 6 servings of steamed or parboiled cruciferous veggies a week, you'll be fine, especially if your background iodine intake is sufficient, which I think it absolutely should be if you have a thyroid condition. One of the things I've been meaning to do but just haven't had time to do is update my article on iodine and hypothyroidism that I wrote, I think, 4 years ago now. In that article, I argued that iodine can trigger or exacerbate autoimmune thyroid disease. And that is true, but it appears to be only true or mostly true when background intake of selenium is insufficient, because selenium can protect against the potentially toxic effects of iodine in people that are susceptible to autoimmune thyroid disease. So in most of my patients with thyroid issues, as long as they are taking enough selenium or getting enough selenium in the diet, iodine doesn't tend to cause any problems or exacerbate their autoimmune condition, especially if they follow the guidelines I've laid out for starting with a really low dose, a few hundred, couple hundred micrograms maybe, and then building up really slowly over time. There are a few patients, however, that do react even to a very small dose, even when their selenium intake is adequate. And in those cases, they might want to exercise a little bit more caution with goitrogenic foods because they may not be able to increase their iodine intake to the point where it's sufficient to protect against the potentially iodine-limiting effects or goitrogenic effects of these foods. So Like always, it's the answer is always the answer depends on your individual circumstances. But I can tell you that in most cases, especially provided that you're able to tolerate either sea vegetables like kelp and hijiki and kombu, dulse, those are all relatively high in iodine. Kelp in particular is very high. Nori is not so high, incidentally. But if you're able to eat seaweeds like that regularly, and then you're or you're taking iodine supplements, then I think the guidelines I just laid out are absolutely fine, and you may even be able to eat more than that without any negative effect. It's also important to point out that a lot of the iodine, the potentially goitrogenic foods are really healthy foods that have a lot of other beneficial properties, like the cruciferous vegetables, for example, have some compounds that some researchers believe are cancer fighting or cancer preventing. And, you know, all the leafy greens like kale and collard greens and are really nutrient dense. So it's probably unwise to remove these foods from your diet altogether. And then the last thing that I want to point out is that pregnant women may also want to be particularly careful with goitrogens, just because it's really important for iodine is a crucial nutrient for pregnancy and the development of the baby, growing baby. So maybe, you know, making sure to get a little extra iodine and maybe dialing back the amount of these foods a little bit would be a wise precaution during pregnancy.
Well, thanks for laying that out. I think goitrogens, at least, you know, from my perspective and kind of taking maybe somebody who doesn't have a Hashimoto's hypothyroid issue, it seems like goitrogens kind of fall into that class of compounds and foods where you can really get lost in the weeds when you look at foods from a whole. But I think you laid it out pretty simple there.
All right, let's go on to the next one.
Okay, this next question comes from Tom. I've been struggling with what seems to be an overactive bladder for some time now. It is mainly a problem when I'm trying to sleep. Before I can fall asleep, I have to get up several times to try and empty my bladder because of the constant sensation that it is full. Then I will wake up multiple times during the night to urinate. Sometimes it prevents me from falling asleep at all for many hours while I make several trips back and forth to the bathroom. I'm 30 years old and have no known health issues. I'm wondering if you know of any causes or possible solutions for this problem.
Well, I mean, I hate to point out the obvious here, but actually in some cases with my patients, this has been the solution, is to, if you're drinking a lot of liquid late in the day, to not do that. So I'll just throw that out there in case that's part of the issue here. It sounds to me like it's only happening at night, and that's the most obvious possibility, that you're just taking in too much liquid at night. There's for a lot of years there was a big emphasis on, you know, drink at least 8 glasses and maybe 12 glasses of liquid of water per day, and there's no research to back that up. And for a lot of people, I think that's actually even a bad idea. And in some cases, I had patients that were just, you know, had been following that recommendation for years, and, you know, not because they were thirsty for that much water, but just because they thought it was a good idea. And then when they cut back significantly, that solved the problem. So I'm assuming that that's not the case, but I just wanted to put that out there. One of the most common causes of frequent urination is chronic urinary tract infection. And of course, this is more common in women, but it's still possible in men, and I've seen it in some men. And sometimes urinary frequency and urgency are really the only symptoms, and they can linger for quite a long time. So getting a urinalysis is probably a good step to take, just if anything, just to rule that out. He's a little young for this, but it can happen. Benign prostate hyperplasia, or BPH, is another really common cause of frequent urination, and symptoms do tend to get worse at night. So if you haven't been checked for that, I would recommend doing that. He didn't mention sleep being an issue, but one of the kind of hidden causes of frequent urination that a lot of people don't know about is sleep apnea. And it's a pretty common problem, actually. Quite a few people suffer from it. So getting a check for sleep apnea is another possibility. And then finally, cystitis or interstitial cystitis. So either like a bladder infection or interstitial cystitis being an autoimmune disorder where the bladder becomes, you know, the immune system attacks the bladder and the bladder becomes irritated. That can cause this kind of symptom profile with few other symptoms actually too. So it can be a little bit difficult to identify and diagnose. So seeing, you know, perhaps a urologist and looking up that condition, seeing if other symptoms match your experience, that could be one of the potential cause. And if it is, of course, all of the things we've talked about in the past to deal with autoimmune conditions from a nutritional perspective, like perhaps trying the autoimmune version of the paleo diet and boosting glutathione levels with either whey protein powder or glutathione precursors or S-acetylglutathione, which we talked about on a previous show, or liposomal glutathione, optimizing vitamin D levels, low-dose naltrexone, getting enough sunlight, all of it, stress management, all of those things are of course, things we've discussed in the past in the context of treating autoimmunity. So those are some ideas, and, you know, check that out and let us know what you find out.
All right, let's roll on to the next one. This one comes from Nathan. It's kind of a sleep theme so far here. He'd like to hear your thoughts on possible causes and solutions for snoring. He's not at all overweight, eating a clean paleo diet, and has no real medical issues that he's aware of. He's claiming that he's a pretty regular snorer, however, but not at all every night, definitely consistently enough to annoy his partner. Is there anything that I can do nutritionally to outright prevent this?
Yeah, so this is, snoring is interesting. It's one of those conditions that's, I think, multifactorial, has a lot of potential causes. It's sometimes those are difficult to pin down. There are a lot of non-specific symptoms associated with it. We just talked about sleep apnea, and I think that's one of the first obvious things to try to rule out, because sleep apnea, snoring can be part of the whole sleep apnea presentation. However, sleep apnea often has other symptoms, such as choking or gasping during sleep, memory loss, high blood pressure, chest pain, depression, headaches, reduced libido, all the kind of things that you'd expect when someone's not getting enough oxygen. And he didn't mention any of those, and his partner would probably notice some of them, especially if she's noticing his snoring. So it's doubtful that's the problem for him. So, but it may be worth checking out. The causes of snoring, as I mentioned, are numerous. From a conventional perspective, it could be an issue with mouth anatomy, like having a large tongue or narrow airway due to a thick, soft palate, an elongated uvula. Could be an issue with nasal anatomy, like a deviated septum, or throat anatomy, like poor muscle tone in the throat, which can be due to aging or other causes. And then chronic nasal congestion due to things like allergies and sinus infection are another possibility. Again, he didn't mention any of these things, but in the event that some of those ring a bell, it's worth considering. In my experience, snoring can also be caused by food intolerances. Snoring is, you know, mostly involves a narrowing of the airway, and if you have like kind of chronic low-grade inflammatory response is caused by gluten or dairy, milk protein intolerance or any other food intolerance, that could certainly contribute. So if you haven't done this already, doing like a 30-day reset with no dairy, and, you know, possibly even the autoimmune modifications if you want to take the extra step, might be a good thing to do. And if it improves during that, then you know that it's nutritionally, you know, has something to do with something that you're eating, and then you can start to add foods back in, try to figure out what's causing it. Some people report that avoiding caffeine and or alcohol, especially in, you know, later in the day for caffeine and at night for alcohol, can make a difference. But there's a whole nother approach to consider here. Assuming you do all that stuff, or you've already done all that stuff and it hasn't worked, there's a device called the Silent Night SL, and it's something you put in your mouth. It's prescribed by a dentist. It's made of, a high-grade BPA-free type of plastic, and it pushes the lower jaw forward using S-shaped connectors that are attached to lower and upper trays. And you can also work with a dentist that specializes in what they call dental orthopedics or functional orthopedics. And they will make a similar device, but they do it in a more sophisticated way that's, really kind of customized for your mouth. So why would they do this and why would this help? Well, we've talked before, and I've written a lot about Weston Price, the dentist back in the 1930s that became interested in why people in the modern world's teeth were so messed up and their facial structure was really different than what he just didn't feel like that made sense from an evolutionary perspective. Why would we evolve to just have our teeth decay and start falling out and be totally crowded in our mouth? It couldn't, he didn't think that was a normal circumstance, even though it was completely normal where, in the industrialized world where he was in the U.S., where he was practicing medicine. So he took off to travel around the world to look at, people's, to make contact with cultures who've had very little Western contact and were still living their traditional diet and lifestyle and find out what, first of all, whether these dental problems that were so epidemic in the industrialized world were an issue in those places. And second of all, if they weren't, what were the common threads in all those different places that he visited that could explain, why their teeth and their facial structure was so good and why ours was so bad. And he published his findings in a book called Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. It's a fantastic book. I highly recommend it for people who are interested in medicine and anthropology and just this topic in general. And he indeed did find that people, traditional cultures around the world that he studied had beautiful, wide faces with often perfectly spaced teeth that meet tip to tip when the mouth is closed. And this is contrasted with the modern face, so to speak, that's characterized by underdeveloped cranial structure and maxilla, the jaw, really narrow faces with weak chins and crowded overlapping teeth with an overbite, which is known as malocclusion in the scientific literature. And this is how he developed, he studied then the nutrition of the people in all these places. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Weston A. Price dietary approach. It's very similar to what I advocate, with a few differences. But it's a nutrient dense diet with no processed and refined foods. And he also was able to observe that people in those traditional cultures, when they adopted a Western diet, they very quickly, even within one generation, would develop all kinds of dental problems, and their offspring would have completely the shape of the faces would change even just within a generation or two generations. Like their children would be born, and you could see side by side, if you look at the pictures in the book, the very wide faces and wide dental arches of the traditional people versus the really narrow faces of the modern industrialized folks. So how does this all relate to snoring? Well, one of the consequences of the underdevelopment of the maxilla is that it narrows the airway and can cause things like mouth breathing and snoring and sleep apnea. And a device like the Silent Night SL, or one that you get working individually with a functional orthopedic dentist, corrects this malocclusion and can have a profound effect on facial physiology, anatomy, and in fact, almost every system in the body, because it's not difficult to understand that, really, when you consider that the hypothalamus and the pituitary and these master hormone control glands are all in the in your head. And so if you have a really different facial structure and anatomy, that could certainly affect the function of those organs and glands. And so correcting that can in turn correct some of those functional problems. And these orthopedic dentists, what they call themselves, or functional dentists, there are quite a few of them in the Bay Area, and anecdotally, I know quite a few people who've worked with them and have seen incredible resolution of problems that you would not at all associate typically, unless you're familiar with this kind of work, with dental, dental issues, like or malocclusion. And my wife actually is one of them, and she had some life, maybe not lifelong, but 20 or 30 year neck pain that just would not resolve no matter what she did. I mean, she's a Feldenkrais practitioner herself, so she's incredibly aware of her own body and how posture and the way she moves and holds her body affects her physiology. She has a number of skilled colleagues that she's worked with. She's done, just about everything you can imagine. And yet in her meditation practice, which she's had for many, many years, she basically would never have a single sitting period where she wasn't in considerable pain in her neck. And literally within days of getting fitted for this dental appliance, and she's working with a local dentist, that pain that she'd had for decades completely disappeared. It was really remarkable to witness, actually. It was like, I'll admit that prior to that, I wouldn't say I was skeptical, because it certainly made a lot of sense from it. It's just another way that we're, another evolutionary mismatch, so to speak, and all the physiology made sense to me. But I was having a harder time really seeing, just understanding how profound the effect could be with multiple different body systems that were seemingly unrelated. And I'm definitely a believer now, having witnessed what she went through. And I know, again, a lot of other people who've done it and had pretty significant changes. So everything from snoring or sleep apnea on the sort of, and I don't mean to diminish the potential seriousness of sleep apnea, which can actually be fatal, but relatively mild problem like snoring, and certainly has worked well for that. But I'm talking about seeing really big shifts in people with like serious autoimmune diseases, in some cases some life-threatening conditions. So it's pretty fascinating. I may end up interviewing Alain's dentist on the show, talk more about it, because it's something that I'm interested in. Stephen Guinet, by the way, has written a series on his fantastic blog called Whole Health Source on malocclusion, and I would definitely recommend checking that out. If you just Google Whole Health Source and malocclusion, it will come right up, or we'll put the links in the show notes. And then there's a great article on the Weston A. Price Foundation's website called Is It Mental or Is It Dental?, which is a great name for an article. So you should read those two things, that series and that article, if you want to learn more about this. And I know it might sound like kind of out there for something like snoring, but it's if you've tried everything and nothing else has worked, I think it's worth looking into.
Well, that's fascinating. I think I would love to hear some other listeners who are listening to this, or readers of your blog, hopefully will comment and let us know who else has used this and what sort of problems resolved when they used it.
Yeah, please do that. Cause I'm relatively certain that there are quite a few people in the, in my audience that are doing this or have done it. And so maybe we can just get a little thread going on the comments there, either in Facebook or on the website, about people's experiences. Cause I think this is is fascinating stuff, and I'm not doing it justice cause I haven't yet taken the time to go really deeply into it. But as I said, I think we can come back to it, especially if there's more interest.
Well, I'm interested because I'd never heard of it. So let's do it.
All right, let's do it. And I'm actually considering doing it myself. I am one of, if you've ever met me in person, you'll know that I'm one of those narrow faces. A lot of people in the industrialized world are. I definitely have an overbite and had orthodontics and all some dental issues when I was a young kid, and I'm curious to see what, you know, what might come of it if I do it. So
we shall see. Let's have some fun in 2013 with our teeth. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's roll on here. This one, I'm sure, will touch everyone who's listening. This comes from Brianna, and she wants to know, very simply, microwaves, yay or nay?
Okay, that is simple.
Very simple.
I might be one of the few freaks in the world now that doesn't use a microwave, but I can't say that it's because of any, you know, safety concern or scientific concern. I think early on, they just kind of freaked me out a little bit, the whole concept of it. And this was before I was really doing a lot of my own research. You know, we're talking about years and years and years ago. Here's what I can tell you. The studies really suggest that they're safe. They do emit some radiation, but it's well below the established limits, even if you're using it like 24 hours a day in your house, which I'm sure nobody is. You obviously want to take basic precautions, like making sure you have a relatively new device with, or a device that's in good shape, you know, where the seals are tight. And if you have any doubt, you know, if the seals look frayed and looks like that it's not closing properly, then of course you'd want to replace it. But provided you take those basic precautions, there's really no evidence that microwaving poses any risk in terms of radiation. And then there's the question of how does it affect nutrients in food? Well, cooking of any kind will change nutrient profile in food, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse, depending on the type of food and the type of nutrient. And microwaving is no different in that regard. But in fact, because microwaving generally is a short, you know, cooking happens more quickly in the microwave, it doesn't tend to have as strong as an effect on depleting nutrients as some other forms of high heat cooking that go on for a long time, you know, like or longer, maybe like stir frying. If you do a stir fry for a long time, it generally preserves nutrients in vegetables. Although there was one study that I found that showed that microwaving brassicas led to lower antioxidant content versus other forms of cooking, but overall, like I said, the balance of studies seem to suggest that microwaving is safe, doesn't reduce nutrient levels, and may even reduce nutrient levels less than some other forms of cooking. Although the studies did seem to suggest that using lower settings on the microwave is probably better for preserving nutrients. So it's really, you know, if you need to use the microwave, it's you're at work and you're going to heat up some food, go ahead. There's no reason not to do it. Personally, I can't, again, say that this is completely rational, evidence-based approach, but I've never liked the microwave. I've never liked what it does to the texture of food, certain foods, and I just, for whatever reason, have never gotten into it. But that's not a reason that you shouldn't use it, or that you should follow my convoluted logic in this case.
Well, I gotta say that I use the microwave a lot. And I would agree with you that it definitely is a different method of cooking. So it definitely ruins the taste and texture of some foods. But the balance of what I've researched as well suggests that it's not harmful to the food in any one way. However, I would, based on my research and my background in electrical engineering, I would say don't stare in the window while it's moving. Go in the other room.
So there we have the electrical engineering perspective. That's great.
Yeah, it's probably worse than, or it's probably not as bad as using your cell phone all day long. But when the microwave is on, just go in the other room. Okay, well, let's move on to the next question. This comes from Sheila. Chris, she wants to know your thoughts on some probiotics being not good, and or I guess there seems to be a lot of confusion out there when it comes to probiotics regarding D-lactate and the specific carbohydrate diet, including VSL number 3, as problematic. There's, I guess, and I can definitely comment on this, there's definitely a lot of things out on the web there saying that bifidobacteria can be a problem when you're doing some diets like SCD or GAPS.
Well, I'd be interested to hear about your experience with this, Steve, but I actually haven't observed that as much. And a lot of people with compromised guts tend to have low bifidobacteria concentrations and really benefit from getting those back up. But oftentimes probiotics with bifidobacteria aren't the best way to do that. I think prebiotics are actually better, have been shown in the scientific literature to have a more potent effect on increasing bifidobacteria levels, because prebiotics are just providing the food that your own internal bifidobacteria need to multiply, and that seems to be a more effective approach than taking bifidobacteria itself. But I want to address the kind of general theme of the question, which is, you know, which probiotics should you take when for what condition? And that I think we're probably just at the very beginning in terms of understanding probiotics and how they work and how to customize them for various health conditions. I mean, even just several years ago, our understanding of probiotics, I think, was a lot more primitive than it is now. And this is something I'm going to be discussing in my Ancestral Health Symposium presentation this year. The notion of how probiotics work has really shifted in the scientific community, at least. Originally, the idea was kind of like, quantitative understanding. So like you have a certain number or amount of probiotic bacteria in your gut, and then that amount can get depleted over time from antibiotic use and other aspects of the modern lifestyle. And so you get, then you need to replace those probiotics, you know, like kind of top them up by taking oral probiotics. And now the understanding is quite different. It's more that probiotic bacteria have been part of our internal environment for as long as we've been human, and a lot longer before that. And they have numerous functions. They perform numerous functions and help regulate and modulate our immune system. And the loss of those probiotic bacteria disrupts our immune function, because we evolved in concert with those bacteria. And we actually probably even outsource some of our immune function to those bacteria, because about 70-80% of our immune system exists in the gut-associated lymphoid tissue, and you know, which is comprised of those bacteria. So it's almost like we need those probiotic bacteria for our immune system to function properly. And so when you take probiotics, what's happening is you're priming or tuning the immune system with because of the way the immune system reacts to their presence as they move through us, whether they are a transient form of bacteria that doesn't actually colonize us, they just pass through, or whether they're the type of bacteria that can actually live in our gut. So that was a little bit of a side note, but I think it's important because it's going to inform the way that we look at probiotics and even particular species of probiotics. So with probiotics, it's not generally a question of whether one species is good or bad, because by definition, probiotics are good. That's part of the way that they're defined, is that they're organisms that have a beneficial effect. It's more about the goal of what you're trying to do and the condition that you have. So different species of probiotics can produce different chemicals and compounds and have different effects on gut function and immune regulation, and you know pretty much every system of the body. So to give you an example, which was Sheila mentioned in the question, some species of bacteria, probiotic bacteria, produce more D-lactic acid, which is a byproduct of bacterial metabolism. And D-lactic acid is broken down much more slowly than L-lactic acid or L-lactate. By a little quick chemistry lesson, lactate and lactic acid are synonymous, or just different ways of expressing it. So if I jump back and forth between those two, I'm talking about the same thing. So when D-lactate accumulates in the gut, it then can get absorbed into the bloodstream, and other factors can enhance D-lactate absorption into the bloodstream, like if you have a leaky gut, or if you're under chronic stress, or if there's a lot of lipopolysaccharide, which is an endotoxin that's produced by some gram-negative bacteria in the gut hanging around, that can increase the rate of D-lactate absorption into your blood. And there are a lot of studies that actually suggest that too much D-lactate in the blood can be problematic. So, for example, there were two species of bacteria that produced D-lactate in higher amounts found in greater concentrations in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. And in an animal study, animals that had excessive D-lactate in their gut exhibited anxiety, aggression, and impaired memory. D-lactate can cross the blood-brain barrier, and it interferes with the energy supply of neurons or brain cells. So these studies involved relatively low grade of D-lactate increases. They weren't like huge, ridiculous doses of D-lactate that you would never get in real life. And the problem is that conventional medicine doesn't really test for D-lactate, although it can be tested for with one of the tests I use frequently in my practice, an organic acids urine panel. So some bells might be ringing for some of you, because we've talked a lot about the gut-brain axis before and the connection between things like SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, and mental health problems like anxiety or depression, insomnia, things like that. And this is one of the mechanisms here. Some, you know, overgrowth of lactate-forming, producing bacteria like Acidophilus in the small intestine. The D-lactate gets across the gut barrier because it's permeable often in people with SIBO, and gets into the blood, goes up, crosses the blood-brain barrier, starts interfering with the energy supply of neurons, and then that can cause all kinds of different problems in the brain. And it's worth pointing out that this can happen even without any gut symptoms. Most people with SIBO do have gut symptoms, but some patients, I've seen them just come in complaining of primarily mental health problems, you know, perhaps a skin disorder or something like that. And I test them for SIBO and find that they have SIBO and they have an overgrowth specifically D-lactate forming species of bacteria like Lactobacillus acidophilus, which is otherwise a good guy, you know, a good bacteria. So, but the problem is when it's overgrown or there's too much of it in the wrong place, it can cause these kinds of issues. So for people that have SIBO, they probably want to avoid probiotics and fermented foods that have high amounts of D-lactate forming species like Lactobacillus acidophilus. And there are a couple of options there. There's a product made by a company called Custom Probiotics, which I don't have any affiliation with, but it's customprobiotics.com, I think, and it's called D-lactate-free probiotic. And it only has species that don't produce much D-lactate. Another option, which I actually prefer at this point, are soil-based organisms like Prescriptocyst. And I'm having more success with that even with patients with SIBO than I was with the D-lactate-free probiotic. I think they can both be useful, but the Prescriptocyst seems to be... it's working really well, and I even started selling that in my store on my website, because it was kind of difficult to obtain before that, and I want people to be able to access it, because it's really I'm having a lot of success with it in a lot of different conditions, not just SIBO. So that's one example. And then another example would be histamine intolerance, which we've talked about a lot, and there's just kind of a lot of chatter about it on the web right now and various forums and stuff, because a lot of people seem to suffer from it from one perspective, you know, at one level or another. And there are genetic causes of histamine intolerance where there's a like single nucleotide polymorphism, which leads to a decrease in the production of diamine oxidase, which is the primary enzyme that breaks down histamine in the body. And, you know, of course, if the cause is genetic like that, you have fewer options in terms of how to remedy it. But another cause, and I think this is the one that's more significant, especially lately, and explains why there's, you know, perhaps more, maybe, I don't have any statistics to back this up, but it seems like it could just be that the increase in awareness of histamine intolerance is what is responsible for, you know, the increase in number of people that are suffering from it. But it could also be that a change in, you know, people's gut flora is responsible, because there are some types of bacteria that are histamine producers, and there are other types of bacteria that are histamine degraders, and there are some types of bacteria that seem to be have a neutral effect on histamine. And of the, you know, 1,000 species of intestinal bacteria that we know about, only a few have been characterized. And then there are also some, you know, the species of bacteria that are found in probiotics and fermented foods, and a lot more of those have been characterized. I found one study that went over 250 different species. So in terms of foods or probiotics, the species that are notorious for histamine production are Lactobacillus casei, C-A-S-E-I, Lactobacillus reuteri, I think is how it's pronounced, R-E-U-T-U-R-I, Lactobacillus bulgaricus, which is in yogurt, and which is one of the reasons why fermented foods are generally off the list with people with histamine intolerance. Neutral species that have been studied include Streptococcus thermophilus, which is also in yogurt, Lactobacillus rhamnosus, and then histamine-degrading bacteria strains include Bifidobacterium infantis, which is one of the strains that's found in breast milk and really important for babies, but it's also been shown to be really effective in IBS, and I wonder if there isn't some correlation there between histamine intolerance in some cases and IBS, but it may not have anything to do with that. I mean, B. infantis, Bifidobacterium infantis, has a lot of beneficial effects. Bifidobacterium longum, which is the more typical kind of Bifidobacteria, and then Lactobacillus plantarum. Soil-based organisms, which we just discussed, appear to be either neutral or histamine degrading, depending on the sources that you look at. In my clinical experience, I think they're degrading, histamine degrading, because I see improvement in people that are taking soil-based organisms that have histamine intolerance. So there's more to this story. It will continue to evolve, but those are two of the best examples of how you'd want to modulate your, or, you know, change your probiotic preference based on a couple of different conditions.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head in two ways. Number one is that it seems like every year we make huge leaps forward in both the execution of using probiotics to help people, as well as the research as far as what's actually going on and why they work. And I think the other thing that I've noticed working with a lot of people and just observing my own health and other people's health over the last 4 years is that it seems like there's a spectrum in which, there's obviously a spectrum in which your health is, but there also seems to be spectrums in which, depending on where your health is, certain types of probiotics might be useful in your progression from, you know, wherever you are when you're very sick to all the way being really healthy. And so I think kind of where they're coming from as far as Bifidobacteria got a bad rap in SED a long time ago from Elaine Gottschall. And I think, you know, what kind of was noticed there is that some people, and I have seen this reaction before, but there's curves of reactions. You know, anyone can have any reaction to any one thing. So, but there has been people who are on the very sick end of like a IBD disorder. And when they do get a Bifidobacteria strain, they tend to react to it. So that's where, I guess, in a lot of really sicker people, I've seen them have the best success kind of sticking to like actually single strain Lactobacillus acidophilus. But as Chris just mentioned, that's just kind of like the beginning stages. And I do think that over time, Bifidobacteria, obviously very immensely powerfully helpful. And, you know, moving on from stages as you heal, I think is really where I'm at with probiotics and how to use them in my own health and with clients.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I think I know we've talked about this before, but one of the things that happens with people on the GAPS diet is I think they get stuck in a particular stage and do it for too long, and then they end up kind of moving back in the other direction. You know, they had an initial benefit and then they start to get worse. And I've had a lot of patients with that experience, and that might be part of the picture there. And it's one of the reasons that you know, working with a practitioner who's familiar with that kind of thing can be so helpful. So I think that's it for this time. Got through a few questions at least.
Yeah. That was a good solid, six five. Questions there. Dang it. We almost made it to six.
Five down, 1200 to go.
Well, we shared a lot of good stuff today, and I think everybody's going to be pretty happy because I know some of these topics were things that affect all of us every day when we make decisions on what we're going to eat or what we're going to do with our health.
Yeah, well, thanks again, Steve, and thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. That helps get us a little more exposure and get the name out there for the Revolution Health Radio Show. Also, if you have any questions that you'd like us to address on the podcast, please head over to chriskresser.com and submit them using the podcast submission link.